Hello, and welcome to this podcast from Consider This. Please let me know what you think and tell others about us on social media. This podcast was originally broadcast live on Northumberland 89.7 FM. You can hear this show live every Friday at noon. Thank you for downloading this program, and I hope you enjoy it.
Hello, I'm Robert Washburn, and welcome to Consider This Northumberland, a current affairs program dedicated to the issues facing our community. We talk to the people on the front lines and those behind the scenes who make a difference in your life and Northumberland County. So I'm asking you, the listener, to take some time out of your busy day to consider this. Well, the Prime Minister visited the Governor General on Wednesday, officially starting the countdown to the federal election on October 21st. For some, the campaign began about a year ago, only there were no lawn signs. Others would say it was a low-key effort taking place quietly as candidates attended events, met in living rooms, knocked on doors, and worked hard to establish their profile. That phase is done. Now, it is a flat-out sprint with all the hands on deck as candidates seek the job of representing us here in Northumberland, Peterborough South. As part of the ongoing efforts of Northumberland 89.7 FM and Consider This, we continue our series of candidate interviews for this all-important job of being a Member of Parliament for our riding. With me today in the studio is the incumbent for Northumberland Peterborough South, Liberal candidate Kim Rudd. Welcome, Kim.
Thanks, Rob. Always good to be here.
Thank you. Last night, the Prime Minister did not attend a televised debate by City TV and Maclean's while the other party leaders did. Was that a good thing to do this early in the campaign?
Well, it's interesting. The Prime Minister provided his reasons for why he didn't, including the fact that as a short period and a very, very large country, he felt his schedule made more sense to be in Edmonton, in Alberta, on his way back from Victoria. And as you know, right now, he's going across the country. If you remember last election, the writ was about 84 days long, starting on August 1st. So there was a lot more flexibility in schedules. That's one thing. But the other is, as you know, to address some of the challenges around the election challenges that happened last time and making sure that they're as fair as possible, there was a board formed. Former Governor General David Johnson heads that board, and there are debates that are organized that board, and the Prime Minister agreed that he would go to those because they're completely accessible to all Canadians. It's, you know, in this riding we have, I think, about 6 or 8 scheduled. I'm not quite sure the number is. I've always made it a policy to attend all of them. Last election, the Conservative candidate chose not to go to all of them. Everybody makes their decision based on their own rationale. And the Prime Minister based his on on both a timeline and making sure that whatever debates he attended were accessible to all Canadians.
Do you think it was a good thing to do?
I don't know if I could answer that, because I don't know I watched the debate, or actually I was out knocking on doors and at a couple of events last night, so I only saw the tail end of the debate. I was kind of surprised at Elizabeth May and Jagmeet Singh, and they seemed to be quite focused on each other. I felt that Andrew Scheer, being in the middle of the two of them, put him in a profile that was not, I don't think it was the profile he wanted, because he really didn't have anyone to debate against. So I don't know. Strategically, was it the best decision? That was the Prime Minister's to make.
Now, there's something like that on a national level. Does that trickle down and affect you here in the riding?
No, I don't believe so. I mean, I have always... I remember years ago debating Janet Eckert was the Minister of Community and Social Services on CBC and Judy Rebick, and I can't remember who the other person was. I enjoy, and I think the ability of, or the function of debates, to be able to get information out to the public. I'm not sure what information came across in that debate last night. As I said, I didn't see it all, but the challenge with debates sometimes, I think, at a national level, is you're appealing or trying to put together a message that appeals to everyone across the country, or as many people are engaged. Whereas in the riding, it's very specific to what those larger platforms, those larger issues, how they relate right here to the riding. So I think it is different.
That's a good transition into my next question, which is, when you're out knocking on doors, what are the issues that you see facing our riding, not included in the list that's put forward by party leaders or the National Campaign Office? What are they saying to you? What are they asking you when they're talking to you at the doorstep?
Well, and that's one of the reasons I love knocking on doors and going to events and coffee parties. It's my favorite thing. And I think, frankly, one of the most productive things you can do is actually face-to-face have a conversation with someone. So I'm certainly hearing about the environment. I'm hearing about the environment and the imperative to deal with climate change. I'm hearing about it from a number of perspectives. But the thing that I'm hearing that sort of goes hand in hand with that is the economy. And making sure we take care of the environment and the economy, and that we find that balance in the ability to not, I think there's a concern with some of the platforms that some of the focus on the environment could cause shocks to the economy, and people are aware of that. So I'm hearing that. I'm hearing seniors, of course, seniors' issues. We have a large senior population, as you know. And seniors, just like the rest of the population, there is a spectrum of those who are struggling to those who are doing very well and trying to respond to what the what their needs are and where they see it important for us to pay attention as we go forward for seniors. The other thing, interestingly enough, is training for what we call the new economy. So as you know, we have the strongest economy in the G7. Canadians have created over 1.1 million jobs, 75% are full-time. We have the lowest unemployment rate in 40 years. What we're finding is that though there are many jobs to be filled, there is a gap between the skill set and the jobs. And so, as you know, as a government, we made a number of announcements to address that. And I was just meeting with the president of Durham College maybe a week and a half ago, and he talked about the example of General Motors and OPG, because when General Motors, you know, the fairly, very large layoff, and I was engaged with them, with OPG, with the colleges and universities to talk about that transition for some of those workers into the nuclear sector. And what they found when they started doing an assessment on those workers, because there was an unfair assumption maybe that the line workers at General Motors primarily, who are the ones that are going to be affected, that there was going to be a huge gap in their skill sets. Interestingly enough, he mentioned that there was about 70% that had solid transferable skills. So identifying that gap and being able to fill that gap and train to allow them to go on to the next job in what we can call the new economy. I'm hearing about that at the doors. And I'm also, of course, I would be remiss if I didn't say I'm hearing concerns about many things on a provincial level in terms of healthcare and education. There's signs all over the communities about cuts to education. There's a concern about healthcare. So I'm hearing that too. Not that it is directly related to the federal government, except in the cases of transfer payments, et cetera, but it always parlays into the conversation about pharmacare, which will be in our platform.
Interesting. There's so much to unpack there. Let's go back just for a second, because you mentioned seniors and you talked about a range of issues, and you were very general. Can you be specific? I mean, you talked about low-income seniors and then high-income seniors. What are the range of issues that they're articulating that are important?
Yeah, it's it really is interesting, because the conversation or the sort of language we use is seniors. But seniors mean different things to different people. People at 70 don't necessarily consider themselves seniors sometimes, and people at 55 consider themselves seniors. So what we found, certainly seniors in the lower income bracket, a couple of things. The increase to OAS and GIS for single vulnerable seniors of about $2,000 that we announced has made a big difference. So if you have, you know, maybe a widow who never worked outside the home, her asset is their rural home in a community, that's all they have, that makes a big difference to allow her to be able to stay in her home. So there's that. There's then the next piece is, what's that housing look like for seniors? Both seniors who do have income and seniors who have lower income. And there's a ribbon cutting coming up for 32 units. You may remember Lou Rinaldi and I announced a joint federal provincial funding to that a couple of years ago. Well, the good news is that we're cutting the ribbon. So housing on a spectrum. What we find are those, so when those 32 units become available, they help increase what I call the continuum of housing. So some of those might be moving from their homes because they're not accessible for them anymore, as an example. That will open up homes for young families and other people. So housing supports the New Horizons grant that I've announced a number of, that for lawn bowling, to help do a joint program for youth and seniors to get them active and in the community. Another grant that we provide in Alderville to help the elders be able to provide teachings of food for their young people, so we make sure that we continue that culture. Accessibility up at the Bewdley Legion, to they had someone fall going into their facility, and so grants, the New Horizons grant, to allow more seniors to be able to access. So it really is a broad range.
Interesting, because you're talking about monies that you've given or have been given by the government to the various organizations. I went back and I started doing some mathematics, and when I looked, since May, you've handed out $2.8 million in this riding, and that doesn't include $5 million for the Newcastle Seniors Large or $4.5 million for the Innovation Fund. Then there was some other innovation funding that you've handed out. I'm not sure if it was part of that 4.5 or it was separate, but there was also $71 million, of course, for the improved internet for Eastern Ontario, and then $3.7 million for legal clinics. Mm-hmm. So just on its own, $2.8 million, that's a lot. You begin to wonder, are you trying to buy our votes with our own money?
Well, Rob, I've lived here for over 40 years, and I have been an advocate on the municipal, provincial, and federal stage all those 41 years, whether I was an elected MP or not. And if you remember back in the days of the Mike Harris days in Ontario, when they were taking away our child care subsidies, I led the fight to get those subsidies back and was successful. So this is nothing new for me. And what I say to people who sometimes are cynical and ask that question, I say, these projects that we're announcing, some of them I have been working on for 3 years. They were applied for under the 2017 budget or 2018 budget. Or as an, one of the things about being an advocate, and here's the perfect example. The $70 million for the Eastern Ontario Regional Network, that was a group of the Warden's Caucuses that got together and with other folks and put together a proposal that was an excellent proposal. Having said that, there were some things, this is taxpayers' money. We have to make sure that it's the right. All the I's are dotted and T's are crossed, as people say. And back probably about 2.5 years ago, maybe a little longer, our rural caucus within government recognized that rural broadband and cell was, for our rural communities, was one of, if not the most pressing issue. And it is, that is lumped in with the, it's called ICED, Industry, Trade, your Economic Development Ministry, and we just felt it didn't have a high enough profile. So we went to the Prime Minister as a group and to Minister Morneau and said, we need a minister dedicated to rural economic development. This is so important, and the number one job that minister will have is the rural broadband and cell. And we got Minister Jordan, and we got the rural broadband and cell. So that's a culmination of a long period of time. So some of the announcements were made now because we've been working on them for 2 or 3 years, and we want to make sure they got out the door.
The news media has reported that the RCMP is hitting a roadblock in its investigation into the SNC-Lavalin because some parliamentarians are invoking confidentiality. Have you been asked for a statement?
I have not.
Would you urge your colleagues to cooperate?
I don't have any knowledge of, as I understand it, the Prime Minister's office and the Prime Minister have been asked whether they have been contacted. And as recently, I think, as 48 hours ago, they said they have not been contacted. So I guess what I would say, and I remember this back a while ago, the RCMP said they don't discuss in public whether they're investigating someone or whether they're not. It's confidential. So the news source that Mr. Fife has is someone else. And so I don't speak to supposition. I have no idea who his source is. But as to my, again, 48 hours ago, I think it was, the Prime Minister's office and the Prime Minister and had said that there had been no contact by the RCMP. So I don't know what to say about that.
Do you agree with the Ethics Commissioner's report that Trudeau violated the Conflict of Interest Act through his attempts to influence the Attorney General, Jody Wilson-Raybould, on the SNC-Lavalin file?
There are parts of his report that I think are important. They're important and they support some of the suggestions that came out of the review that was done by Anne McClellan. You remember she was tasked with looking at whether to separate the Attorney General and the Minister of Justice. I have read the report, and my guess is not a lot of people have read the report, but they've read some headlines. And I will say that one of the things I'm concerned about the report is that there is a lot of personal commentary in it about his opinion and personal commentary about, in fact, there were a number of lawyers that had a op-ed in one of the newspapers that said they felt he actually erred in law, that there was not data to back up some of the supposition he made. I'm not a lawyer. I read the report. I think the Prime Minister was fighting for jobs, for 9,000 jobs in Canada, some of those jobs right here in this riding. I'll continue to fight for jobs as well. I didn't write the report. I think there are some things in there we can learn from, and I'll leave it at that.
But why not just apologize and move on? Why doesn't your government just do that?
Well, that's a question you have to ask the Prime Minister. From my reading of his comments on this, he firmly believed that he was doing what he was supposed to do to ensure that this whole issue was looked at in the broadest sense. It's the first time it's ever been done in Canada as a new process. The request to the Attorney General to have the former Chief Justice, Beverly McLaughlin, review to make sure that we were doing it properly. I think those are reasonable requests. The Attorney General did not, and they had a difference of an opinion. And Jody's testimony, Jody Wilson-Raybould's testimony at committee, which I did not watch, but I did read, she clearly stated that nothing criminal happened, and she said it more than once. So I guess I just think this is, if I were to be cynical, I'd say this is Andrew Scheer trying to create a news cycle that takes people off the important things that are important to Canadians, and certainly things that are important to people in this riding.
Well, I hear what you say, that nothing criminal happened, but I think there's a difference between law and ethics. Ethics is about behavior, and we're talking about a conflict of interest rather than a law being broken and behavior. If you were put in the position of making that decision, or you were in a position, would you have apologized and just gone on with it? Do you think that an apology is necessary?
I guess I would have to say, Rob, that I was not in those rooms. I was not part of. If I felt I was in the wrong about something, I'm happy to apologize. If I didn't feel I was in the wrong, then I think there's a difference of opinion about where that line is, and I'll leave that to the Prime Minister to make his decision.
All right. Do you think though Jody Wilson-Raybould was treated fairly by your party?
I will say that I. Fortunately or unfortunately, depending on how you come to it, I have more knowledge than the average person. And in my opinion, I supported both Jody and Jane, who's a dear friend of mine. I supported them both being removed from caucus because, as always, we are very cautious about caucus confidentiality. So I won't break it. But I can tell you that based on a number of things that will never be reported in the press, I expect, or I hope they won't, actually. I supported it.
And do you believe in the rule of law?
I do.
So justice should be blind then, and equal. We should all be equal before the courts then. Why did your government pass a law that gives corporations a break, allowing the deferred prosecution agreements? I mean, why not just let NC-Lavalin go to court and let the court sort it out and, you know, it all... Why does it even have to be anything other than that?
Well, actually, the deferred prosecution process started under Stephen Harper. You may remember that in 2014.
Mm-hmm.
And the rationale by Mr. Harper was that other countries had this process. We did not. And that Canadian companies, whole Canadian companies particularly, are very few and far between. And it was a recognition that companies make mistakes, that companies like SNC-Lavalin, who had a terrible track record over a good number of years. And they went in, they replaced their board, they replaced their senior executive a couple of years ago, and said, okay, we realized that there was, some... I don't want to say rotten apples in the barrel, but you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
And we want to turn over a new leaf. And we want to keep these jobs in Canada. We want to keep the contribution we do to the Canadian economy. And people have to remember, people think SNC-Lavalin is a company in Quebec, but they work all across the country. And there are companies right here in our riding, I absolutely know for a fact, that get business, significant amounts of business, because SNC-Lavalin specs them into their projects. So when I look at that process that was started in 2014, the idea was that the process would be there similar to many other countries. And again, because it was the first time, there was a real concern that we did it right, that we didn't make a mistake. And the Attorney General had the right to make the decision all by herself. No one is saying that she did not. But the reality is, I guess if I were a surgeon and I was trying the newest procedure ever, do I want to bring in someone who maybe has already done this in trials before to make sure I'm doing it right? I think I would. So I guess it depends. But I think the process started in 2015, culminated. It was the first time it's being was going to be used. Again, I think we need to make sure we have a level playing field with other countries around the world. And it's not... What you don't want to do, I think, is punish a company who has admitted making mistakes and trying to find their way forward when there's 9,000 jobs at risk.
Okay. Well, when we come back, we're going to talk about climate change and a whole bunch of other things. But now we're going to take a break for some commercials. I'm talking to Kim Rudd, the incumbent Liberal candidate for Northumberland Peterborough South. Please stay tuned to Consider This on Northumberland 89.7 FM, your truly local source for news. We'll be right back. Hello and welcome back. This is Consider This Northumberland, and I am your host, Robert Washburn, and you're listening to Northumberland 89.7 FM. My guest today is Kim Rudd, MP for Northumberland Peterborough South, and we're talking about her platform in the upcoming federal election on October 21st. Before we get back into the issues, tell us a bit about yourself, just in case there's somebody out there that is new to the area or has been living under a rock.
Well, Rob, we came here, Tom and I came here in 1978 for what we thought would be a couple of years with his job, because we had been moved a couple of times. And every time an opportunity came up, we kept talking ourselves out of it because we loved it so much here. So our oldest daughter turned 40 on Monday. Wow. Our youngest daughter is going to be 39 this in December. And so it kind of puts life in perspective for you. I have three grandchildren in their 20s and proud of all of them. Our daughter, Allie, has been married to her wife, Kathy, for, gosh, I think it's about 11 or 12 years now. And Stephanie is a lawyer. She's a teacher. Allie's a teacher in Kitchener-Waterloo. And Stephanie is a lawyer, a family law lawyer. I don't know how she does it, frankly. It's a tough job. And she's married to Ziad. Ziad and he's an accountant, and they've been married now for probably 3 years in February. They got married at Victoria Hall in the Old Bailey because she's a lawyer. Anyways, Tom and I have, you know, been in this community, as I said, for over 40 years. Most people know Tom as not just the engineering sales manager at Belden, but also as a referee and a hockey coach and a ball coach and played old-timers for years. And as you know, I started Cook School Daycare in 1985. It is celebrating its 35th anniversary coming up. It's hard to believe. And I knocked on the door the day before, of someone who is a child of a child that went to Cook. So I'll tell you, I felt all of my, you know, 62 years of age that moment. Those are the roots. And as I go to, you know, communities like Kendall or Keene or wherever I happen to be, I always know where I'm going because I've hit every ball diamond and soccer pitch and arena in this community over the years. So I'm passionate about our community. Chair of Physician Recruitment, when we brought 8 physicians when we were in the crisis there a number of years ago, that feels good. And, you know, like I said earlier in the show, I've been an advocate in this community for over 40 years, elected or not, and I'll continue to be.
Do you remember the moment when you became passionate about politics?
Actually, I probably became passionate about politics when I was a child, unknowingly. My grandmother was a shop steward at Lloyd's Baby Carriages. She was a seamstress and made bus seats and carriage covers. My mother, when my father, my parents died very young at 44 and 58. And when my father, he was in a fire and he couldn't work, and my mother left her job as a cashier to go work in a factory because we needed to. We didn't have a lot. We had many challenges. I had grew up with many challenges in our family, all of which I said made us stronger, or at least made me stronger. And my mother, we were struggling a ton as a family. And the union at Lufkin Tool and Barry kind of embraced my mother and our family. And that really started my mother on her role. She became one of the first female staff organizers for the Steelworkers Union. She was the organizer of the famous Tandy Radio Shack strike. She ran for the NDP back in the day in the riding, in a very conservative riding in Simcoe County that had no hope, but it was important to her. And just after she passed away, I was asked to speak. I was chair of the Ontario Coalition for Better Childcare. I've had a number of volunteer roles, as you know, and I was asked to speak at their Canadian Labour Congress conference that was being held in Toronto, and I got up, and I'd just been going through my mother's things, and I had the program from the first CLC meeting, the Women's Commission meeting, where they struck a committee, a women's committee, to deal with childcare. I still have it. And I ran into someone, actually, when I was sitting on the finance committee, the steelworkers came to speak to us. And he remembered my mother, and he came up to me, and they had just celebrated the 30th anniversary of that committee. So I get goosebumps. So when did I first get interest in politics? I think it might be in my blood. But certainly as an advocate for childcare and small business and post-secondary education, I was presenting to standing committees on finance provincially and federally, on childcare, on small business years ago.
Amazing. Let's talk about climate change, because you identified that as something that's been really important when you've been knocking on doors, and I know many people feel the same. Is there any chance your party would change or alter its policy on carbon-based fuel tax?
You mean the price on pollution? So, no. You know, Nobel-winning economists have said this is the right thing to do. Countries and economists around the world are doing it. And is it the only thing to do? Absolutely not. But it's one measure, and it's the biggest jump we can make, if you will. And the thing about our system is that 90% of the revenue, in fact, the 3 court challenges have happened in Canada, Ontario, Alberta, and Saskatchewan. The courts have all said it is not a tax, because a tax means you take the money and you keep it. Well, we're not. We're taking the money in an effort to change behavior. And we're providing all of that revenue. 90% goes back to you, me, everyone who files an income tax return. And it's an average of about 300 and a bit per family. And it will go up as the cost of price on pollution goes up. The return will go up to citizens. The other 10% is going to what they call the MUSH sector, municipalities, universities, schools, and hospitals. And it is to help them increase their efficiency in terms of using less heat, less air conditioning, new windows, that kind of thing. There was a program through the provincial government, and it was stopped by the Ford government. And so the reason 10% is going to them and not back to the citizenry is because we recognize somebody needed to fill that gap for the college or for the MUSH sector, and that's why we did that. So not even administration is coming out of that revenue.
Okay, I know this is going to sound nitpicking, but I can imagine there's people out there saying, wait, you said 90% is coming back, 10% we're keeping. Now, you defined a tax as money that you keep, so aren't you in fact
No, really we're not keeping it. No, sorry, we're not keeping it. 90% is going to individuals. This is a better way to explain it. 90% is going to individuals. The other 10% is going to organizations such as hospitals, schools, universities, and municipalities. And it is to help them reduce their costs, which in turn will help us. So not one cent is being kept by the federal government. It is all going back to citizens and to organizations.
Last week we had Philip Lawrence on, and we were talking about climate change, and we were talking about this carbon-based fuel tax that he was explaining to us, that this makes all goods and services more expensive. He must have said that a number of times. How do you respond to that when people say, well, wait a minute, you know, now my food costs more, now it costs me more to travel, it costs everybody everything, it's permeating our economy?
I think it's a good slogan if you want to have people accept it without understanding all of the facts and the underlying science behind it. So, as I said, the average family is getting back just over $300 this year, which is calculated to be more than what it is going to cost them. So net, it's actually not costing the average Canadian. The whole idea that we would ignore climate change to the degree that, let me rephrase that. Part of how we have to deal with climate change is we have to change behavior. We absolutely have to change behavior. And in order to do that, people need to think twice about how they're doing things. So as an example, one of the things that, I know it doesn't sound like a big thing, but we have a new clean fuel standard coming out. And if you remember back in the old days, vehicles were run on 100% gasoline, and then ethanol was brought in, and it changed, and the car manufacturers said they were going to go out of business because it was going to, you know, they had to retool, less oil and gas used, et cetera, et cetera. But it didn't, and it made the cars more energy efficient and reduced greenhouse gases. So we have put in a new fuel standard that comes out in 2020, planning to come out in 2020, and it is increasing that amount of biofuel, because biofuel is coming from other places besides ethanol now. It's coming from forest waste. It's coming from all sorts of places. And so measures like that, again, so I bought a new car. I had to buy a new car. And so I bought a hybrid because it made me think twice about how much gas I'm paying and how much gas I'm using and what I can do to reduce my carbon footprint. That's about changing behavior. So, and it can be the little thing to just shutting off the lights, teaching your children to shut off the lights, or getting a smart thermostat, or just shutting your thermostat down in the evening. All those things make you think twice.
How do you square a circle when it comes to your government's actions on the Trans Mountain Pipeline? You know, at the same time, you want voters to believe you guys are serious about dealing with environmental issues, especially climate change, and yet you've been fighting very, very hard to put in this pipeline that's going to transport bitumen across northern Alberta and British Columbia. There's concerns about a possible spill in the ocean. How do you justify that?
Well, as you may remember, I was the parliamentary secretary to the Minister of Natural Resources for 3 years, and I did have opportunity to tour the oil sands and up in Fort Mac, and I was in Edmonton, Calgary, and got to hear firsthand from folks who work and live there how important that industry is to them, and broadly how important it is to our economy. And we have a responsibility, and I would argue an imperative, to use our natural resources to benefit all Canadians and indeed to benefit other countries in the world. And Tom and I were out in British Columbia in April, and rather than fly back, we took the train. And I'll tell you, the 16 hours we were pulled over on the sidings because of the oil cars going by train out to the west, the oil is still going. But it's going by tanker truck and it's going by train. And the pipeline is the most energy efficient way to get it to the resources to market. And these resources are going to countries that are burning coal. They're burning dung. They are burning things that are causing huge amounts of greenhouse gas. And indeed, our clean oil can help them reduce their greenhouse gas. And it's the same thing with the LNG plant in northern British Columbia. I did hear Elizabeth May say something about it on the debate last night. But what Elizabeth failed to mention is it's the first LNG plant that is going to be run by hydro-powered electricity. So the actual footprint of producing that LNG is significantly lower than it has ever been. And that LNG, again, is all going to Asia to reduce their environmental footprint and help them get off coal. So I can square the circle or circle the square, depending on how you want to look at it, because I do believe that in the short and long term, it is a benefit to our fight against climate change and continues to reap the benefits for our economy. Again, going back to where we first started, we have to make sure that what we're doing on the environment is not incongruous with what needs to be done with the economy. And I think they can be done hand in hand.
There's several Indigenous groups out there that have petitioned the courts one more time to see if they can't stop the pipeline, claiming that the consultations haven't been properly done. And your government has put Indigenous issues very much at the center of its mandate over the last 5 years. How do you feel about the way that the consultations have been taking place within the Indigenous community out there?
Well, I've been engaged in some of those, not in the consultations for the hearings, but certainly in my role with Indigenous communities, a number of chiefs. There is an Indigenous group that has been formed to ensure that the benefits of the natural resources that are being extracted are going to the Indigenous communities, and they see it as an economic opportunity for their Indigenous business. So I think in 2015, when we came into government, there was a process in place that really, and I'm probably not being very kind, but steamrolled over the Indigenous and environmentalists questions or issues that needed to be considered. We did what we felt was a reasonable effort to put in additional supports to make it more robust. There were those that when they were completed felt it wasn't enough. So it went to the courts. As you know, the courts told us there were two things we needed to do. We did those two things. And I have talked to many, many Indigenous communities, individuals and chiefs and others who support this, the Trans Mountain expansion. There is already a pipeline there. It is going to be built beside it. They support it. They see it as an economic opportunity to increase the prosperity for their own individual communities, not just for the work that they will get, but for the revenue it will generate, because they will get benefit from that. Yes, there are some who still are not supportive. I don't know, Rob, if you'll ever get, it's like Indigenous communities are no different than the rest of us. We won't always get agreement by everyone on everything. And so you do the best you can, and I think we have done a very good job.
A lot has been done and a great deal of attention given to advance Indigenous people and address issues. In your mind, what are the next steps that have to be taken if you're reelected as a government?
Well, certainly there are a couple of things. The Truth and Reconciliation report is such an important piece of work. I've taken the time to read it. There are a number of things, as you know, being worked on in that report. There were hindsight's always 20/20. There were many things that happened that should never have happened, and we can't change what happened. But there has been over the last 4 years a coming together of Indigenous peoples and the government of Canada. Is it perfect? Nothing ever is. But there is a concerted effort and a joint vision to work on this together. I had a great conversation with President Clem Chartier. He is the president of the Métis Nation of Canada, and I've gotten to know him over the past few years, as well as Perry Bellegarde. And Perry Bellegarde is, and both of them have come out clearly and said, this is the most work and the most money that's ever been spent on reconciliation in the history of Canada, and it is the most progress we've seen. And they see that there is absolutely more work to do, but that we are making progress.
Do you think if your party was returned to government that you would get enough legislation and policy in place to render the Indian Act mute?
That's a really good question. The amount of work that has been done over the past 4 years has put us in a very good place to accomplish exactly that. I would hope we would, and I certainly have been supportive of it and will continue to work towards that.
Precarious labor abounds in our riding. In fact, many people have to leave this area to find full-time work, or they need to have multiple jobs in order to earn a living. They often take jobs where there's no benefits or a pension. And what is your government going to do in the next term to bring full-time employment to Northumberland, Peterborough South?
So there are a couple of things. And so the work, I can't remember what the new name of it is, but it's the working tax benefit, basically. And it's for low-income people. The Canada Child Benefit, which was a game changer for families in this riding, and one I continue to marvel at the difference
it's making. Wasn't there something like, what was it, $5.6 million came to this riding alone for
every month.
Every month, yes.
Every month, $5.6 million every month. Okay. I've had, you know, a couple with two young children. They both make minimum wage. They were living in terrible conditions. Come in and there are tears about the fact their kids now have a yard and they're above ground. It's made a huge difference. But there was a gap between, identified gap between families, and it's important, $5.5 million a month. We're seeing the benefit in small businesses and communities, because if you live in a community like Hastings, you're spending your money in Hastings.
Okay,
so we've seen that.
Jobs.
But the working tax benefit is around $1,200 a year, and it's designed to help those low-income, precarious workers, single workers even. It's a new benefit for them to help with some of those expenses they have in trying to manage their employment life. The skills gap I mentioned. So there are many jobs in this riding. You go just Watton Employment Services. I've talked to a number of employers. I do main streeting, and just I've been doing it for 4 years, just stopping and talking to businesses and saying, how are things? Everybody tells me they need people. There's a shortage of people. So the challenge is, what's the skill gap between the people who are looking for work and the workers or in the companies or businesses who need those workers? So that's what I mentioned earlier about the significant amount of money put into retraining, trades, and those kinds of supports, as well as, and it's not always that someone needs a new career. They may, but sometimes it's just bridging. Maybe they worked at something for 20 years and their skills aren't up to where they need to be to take on a new role. So there's certainly that. And I guess the other thing I would say is making sure that that we have the environment. Venture 13 and the work that's being done there in entrepreneurs creating new jobs, we have seen what that has done to help afford good paying jobs for the people in this community.
But don't we find that employers, why is that piece always left out when we talk about job creation? That employers, you know, how many times do employers employ people so they don't have to pay pensions, they don't have to pay benefits, and yet they're hiring all kinds of people through this cycle where, why don't you just hire them for 44 hours, pay the pension, pay the benefits, and give people a decent job? Why is that piece of the puzzle seem to be missing?
That's a very good question. And I would hope that there are less and less employers doing that. One of the reason we are bringing PharmaCare into our platform is because we see, to your point about no benefits, that Andrew Scheer said something, 95% of Canadians had coverage. I don't know where he got that number, but it's absolutely not even close to being true. I can walk down on the street and just ask random people. There's people who work in those precarious kinds of employments don't have benefits. They don't have pensions. So Canada Pension, as you know, we have strengthened. So in the next generation that's coming, they can expect to get 50% more than what we would be receiving now. That's important to address part of that gap. We've also just announced yesterday an increase in the opportunity for first-time homebuyers to be able to get into homes. That's an important. It's important for people, for places to live, especially young people who are trying to buy a house and struggling. It's also important for our economy because it means more houses and more places will be built. So there is a gap, and there is a moral obligation, I think is where you're going, Rob, for employers to make sure that their employees are taken care of. I'm going to say that is the majority of employers, ones I've talked to and ones I've met. Is there a portion out there that maybe aren't? I think you're probably right, but that's something we need to address, and I agree with you, it's not right, and how do we do it? Well, I think we're going to have to work together to figure that out.
We could do this for a lot longer.
I think we could.
I certainly, lots more questions, but you got to stop somewhere, and our time is running out. So I want to thank you, Kim, for coming in. And as we get closer to Election Day, maybe not for so long, but maybe we'll have you come back quick. And just anything that changes over the next couple of weeks, we'll have you talk a bit about that as well. Maybe that would be nice.
Well, that'd be great. I'll probably be 10 pounds lighter after knocking on doors.
You'd be fading away. So thank you very much. If you have any comments, questions, rants, or raves about this show, please email me at considerthisnorthumberland@gmail.com, or you can go to my Facebook page, Consider This. Or if you're on Twitter, you can message me at rwash. I will read out a selection of comments on next week's show. If you would like to listen to this or share any of my podcasts, please check out my website at consider-this.ca. There you'll find past podcasts, news, and other information about life and politics in Northumberland County. Or if you can go to the radio station's website at northumberland897.ca. I'm Robert Washburn. Thanks for taking time out of your day to listen in, and I hope over the week you will continue to consider this.